Good afternoon. This is Marco, and you're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. Today, we have a special treat for our listeners. We have a NASA scientist in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, Miss Trina Ray, who is working on the Cassini mission. Good afternoon, Trina. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great, Marco. I hope your listeners really enjoyed the interview today.
Yes.
Cassini's a great mission, and we're going to talk about some interesting stuff.
So today we're going to talk mostly about Cassini. It's a spacecraft that NASA built. It's in orbit in the Saturn system. But we're also going to talk about something that Trina did years ago. She worked on the Voyager spacecraft. Trina, could you please tell us a little bit about your educational background and also when you started with NASA?
Absolutely. I was going to college in Southern California, and I was majoring in physics and astronomy, and I decided, just like every good college student, when they get that recommendation, to try to have a good summer internship in between my sort of my summer of my sophomore year and the summer of your junior year. And so I decided to apply to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is one of the local companies, and I was lucky enough to get hired by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to work on the Voyager project just in time to be part of their very last great encounter, the Neptune encounter, and that was back in 1989.
Can you please tell us a bit about your duties, what you did on that specific Neptune encounter?
Oh, it was so exciting. I was like, that was my first job, and so my role was so tiny. I was part of what was called the General Science Data Team, and that was a time when we had to, we didn't have all these fast computers that we have now, and we didn't have easy ways to transfer data to and from our scientists. So there was a team that had to take the telemetry from the spacecraft and package it up and get it to the scientists, and also had to get particular data sets plotted for them ahead of time so that they could do their work every day. And so that was what I did. It was just the tiniest role on the mission, but it really sparked in me just an absolute love and enjoyment of working for the space program, and in particular on robotic exploration of the solar system. And it's something now that I've been doing for, gosh, over 25, 26, 27 years now.
Sounds great. So can you please let our listeners know a little bit about the Voyager mission and where the Voyager spacecrafts are now?
Oh, the Voyager missions would, I think, easily go down as one of the greatest missions that NASA has ever launched. The spacecraft were launched back in 1977. So remember, that was when President Carter was the president and Star Wars was in theaters, right, to give you a sense of how old the spacecraft are. And they did great encounters of the outer planets, in particular the gas giants. Both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, so these are twin spacecraft, went to both Jupiter and Saturn, and then Voyager 2 went on to Uranus and Neptune. And where they are now is Voyager 1 has just passed in the last, it was about 2 years ago, has just passed sort of an epic milestone in that they have exited the solar system and now out in interstellar space. So the first spacecraft that humans have ever built that has exited the solar system and gone into interstellar space is Voyager 1. And Voyager 2 is behind Voyager 1 because it went to Uranus and Neptune. Its trajectory got bent a little bit, and it isn't headed out as fast as Voyager 1. I mean, it's going as fast, but its direction isn't quite headed straight towards the nose of our solar system. And so Voyager 2 is a little bit behind. And by little bit, we mean 2, 3, 5, 10 years behind and then it will also exit the solar system and enter into interstellar space.
So when you're talking about these spacecraft, they're very far away and they send data. What kind of power do they send it at, and how difficult is it to receive or translate this data?
Oh, gosh, especially for something like Voyager, where it takes many tens of hours for the data traveling at the speed of light on radio waves to get from the spacecraft to the Earth. And this is a tiny little transmitter on board the spacecraft. And then the spacecraft has a large dish, a high gain antenna that looks just like a radio dish, you know, where that you use to get sort of that you've all seen maybe in the movie Cosmos, right? You know,
sure.
Where they listen. We listen with giant radio dishes on the Earth, and then the spacecraft have very large radio dishes that they have on them. Now, the one on the spacecraft is about, maybe 5 or 6 feet in diameter. And, of course, the ones on the Earth are, 70 meters in diameter. So those two efficiencies that you gain by having those big antennas magnify that little tiny signal from the radio receiver so that we can hear it here. On the Earth.
What's the power of the signals it sends? Like, what's a comparable here on Earth you can compare it to?
So, let's see. It's in watts, and it's small. It's sort of, 10 or 20 watts. So, sort of the power that goes into the refrigerator light bulb that you have in your refrigerator.
Wow, that's
amazing. Is the power that powers the Voyager radio receiver.
So, it's quite difficult to get that signal or not?
Oh, quite difficult. Yes, we had to build ever bigger dishes here on the Earth. Because once you've built and launched the Voyager spacecraft, you can't change the size of its dish. So when it was launched back in 1977, they did not have 70-meter dishes here on the Earth. They had 34-meter dishes and 11-meter dishes, which were just fine if you want to communicate with a spacecraft that's at Jupiter or Saturn. And then they built bigger dishes. They built 64-meter dishes to help listen to the Voyager spacecraft when it got around the Uranus encounter. That was in the mid-80s. And then they actually built the 70-meter dishes to help listen to the Voyager spacecraft when it got out to Neptune.
Where are these dishes?
And, of course, it's the 70 meters are the only thing that can hear the Voyager spacecraft now.
Are there a number of dishes or just one dish on Earth to receive?
So the dishes, the Deep Space Network is also managed by NASA-funded. The Deep Space Network is also funded by NASA, and in fact, it's managed out of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in Pasadena, and it has three stations around the world. And if you imagine, as the world is spinning in your mind, and one of the stations is in California, and one of the stations is in Spain, and one of the stations is in Australia. So you can imagine, as the Earth is spinning in your mind, you could one of those stations is going to be pointed near your spacecraft. So as the Earth rotates every day, your spacecraft, wherever it is in the sky, first California can see it, and then Australia can see it, and then Madrid can see it, and then the whole cycle repeats itself. And so at each complex, Deep Space Network complex, we have a single 70-meter and then multiple 34-meters and then some other antennas. So there's at least three 70-meter stations, one at California, one in Spain, and one in Australia.
Great. How much longer do you expect to hear from the Voyagers?
So the Voyager spacecraft will run out of power sometime between, 2020 and 2025, and slowly we'll have to start turning off the remaining instruments at that time, and it will run out of power to talk to us with where it's returning science data is when we power off the last instrument, but it'll still send back a signal that's just the carrier signal that says, I'm alive. And still transmitting.
Great. Okay, we're going to pause now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about this prominent scientist, Miss Trina Ray, about what she's doing now, and I think it's in the Saturn system. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on 101.9. Welcome back. We're with a prominent scientist from NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. This is Miss Trina Ray. Now she is working on another project. Miss Ray, can you please tell us what you're doing now and what you've been doing the past few years in terms of the Cassini mission? And I guess you would have to tell our listeners, what is the Cassini mission?
So the Cassini mission is a fabulous mission. It's a spacecraft the size of a school bus, and it was launched in 1997, and it went to the Saturn system, and it arrived in the Saturn system in 2004, and it's been orbiting the Saturn system ever since. We partnered with the European Space Agency to have a probe on the mission, and that probe was called the Huygens probe, and that probe landed, drifted through the atmosphere and landed on the surface of Titan, which is the largest moon of Saturn and one of the only moons in the solar system that is completely enshrouded in a thick atmosphere.
Great. Can you tell us, what are some of the similarities between the moon Titan? I believe it's the second largest moon in the solar system, and it's Saturn's largest moon, and the Earth. What similarities do we share with Titan?
We actually share a lot of similarities. Titan, as I said, has a thick atmosphere. And if you look across the entire solar system at all of the bodies that have a thick atmosphere, you would count Venus sort of as the number one, right? How thick the Venus atmosphere is. And then Titan would probably be number two, and then the Earth would be number three, and Mars would be number four, and everybody else is just sort of so small in comparison that it almost, you know, those are the top four ones. But isn't that interesting that it's Venus, Earth, Mars, and Titan? And so Titan, in some ways, has a lot of similarities with the Earth. So there's this thick atmosphere, and the atmosphere interacts with the surface. So there's wind and erosion, and that, you know, that sort of thing. So when we think about sort of something that doesn't have an atmosphere, like our moon has a whole bunch of craters, and the craters, once they're there, nothing affects them until another crater comes along and smashes into it, or if there's some heating event that melts something, and then, you know, there's a lot of different things. But on Titan, the atmosphere picks up little pieces of stuff and smashes it into things, and you have erosion. But the thing about Titan, even though it's very Earth-like, the thing to remember is that it's familiar physics but unfamiliar substances. So on the Earth, we have mountains, and the mountains are made out of rock. And when a piece of a mountain falls off and starts to, you know, as it erodes over time, there's a big, huge boulder. And then sometimes the boulder smashes into smaller pieces, and sometimes those pieces get caught up in the river that's nearby. And the river takes those pieces of rock and tumbles them around and smooths them out into river rock. And then as it heads towards the ocean, those rocks bump against each other, and they grind off little tiny pieces of rock until you have sand, and so then you dump a whole bunch of sand towards the end of the river. And so you have this whole process that happens with rock on the Earth. But on Titan, that happens with ice. The mountains are made out of water ice. And when a piece of a Titan mountain falls off, it's a gigantic ice, you know, boulder, ice cube boulder. And when it breaks into pieces, it's pieces of water ice that then chip away at each other, and then you end up with tiny little grains of ice. And the little pieces of ice then get covered with this sort of hydrocarbon goo that comes out of Titan's atmosphere. And that turns into the sand particles that then create the gigantic sand dunes on Titan. So sort of circling back to, you know, what are things on Titan that are similar to things on Earth? On Titan, they have dunes that are near the equator that go for 1,000 miles. And the dunes are, you know, they're not outrageously high or outrageously far apart. You know, they're very reasonable, very similar, say, to the Arabian dunes. And they're caused by sort of the same thing. Wind comes along and knocks all the little particles one way, and then comes along and knocks all the little particles the other way. And so here we have this moon that has dunes. It also has lakes and rivers, but it's not water that's in the lakes and rivers. It's ethane and methane, liquid ethane and methane. It's so cold out there that the water is frozen solid. And so you have ethane and methane in the lakes and in the rivers, and then there's evaporation and other ways that it gets into the atmosphere, and then so you have methane clouds and methane rain. So all the things that you think about and know about here on the Earth are happening on Titan. They're just happening with different substances and at different temperatures.
Wow, that's amazing.
And it's just so exciting to study a moon like that.
How did you image this? Did you image it with the Cassini spacecraft, the Huygens probe, and did you have to use visible light or infrared light? Which kind of light
Exactly. You have exactly the right question, is how do you image? So visible light, of course, just like anybody who lives, well, I guess you're up in Vancouver, so
sure.
You perhaps don't have as much smog as we have down here in Los Angeles.
Okay.
But in Los Angeles, we have quite a lot of smog. And when you have smog in the sky, you can't see beyond it. Little particles that are suspended in the atmosphere make it hard to see things behind it. And that's what happens in Titan's atmosphere. The little particles of hydrocarbon that get suspended in the atmosphere make it hard to see down to the surface. So in visible light, you can't see down to the surface. You have to go into the infrared, and you can see down to the surface, but only in a few wavelengths. And even in the visible light, there's at least one little window where the methane has sort of they're methane windows, and you could see down to the surface of Titan. And then in the infrared, you can see down to the surface. And, of course, we also knew from the Voyager spacecraft, and Voyager had flown by Saturn back in the early 80s. We knew that Titan had a thick atmosphere, and we learned with the Voyager flyby that it was a nitrogen atmosphere with methane suspended in it. And so we knew that we needed to bring something that would be able to penetrate that. So we brought a radar instrument on our spacecraft with us. And the radar instrument can bounce straight through those clouds down to the surface. And we can see the surface in very high resolution. So we have the radar instrument can see down to the surface. The infrared cameras can see down to the surface. The regular cameras can see down to the surface, but only at that one little wavelength that penetrates in the methane window. And then the Huygens probe, of course, physically drifted down to the surface. But that only happened in one spot, right near the equator, and at one time, of course, when you have a probe.
So does Titan have a magnetic field as well?
So that's a great question as well. Titan's magnetic field is small. We continue to try to measure it, and we've asked the spacecraft team to try to get us closer to Titan so that we can measure it. The thing is Titan's atmosphere is so thick that if we get too close, then the spacecraft wouldn't be able to maintain, attitude control authority. So, you know, that we have little thrusters on board the spacecraft that make sure that it sits up and that it turns around and turns to the right and turns to the left and does all the things it's supposed to do to change and maintain the attitude. But once you get into Titan's atmosphere is so strong that it actually starts knocking the spacecraft over. So we can't get very deep into Titan's atmosphere. As deep as we have gone, the magnetic field kind of is smaller than that, right? We keep lowering the upper limit. And there's two kinds of magnetic fields. There's sort of a induced magnetic field and an intrinsic one. And, of course, what we're really after is the intrinsic magnetic field of Titan, which, so for right now, what I can tell you is that it's small. And that question will have to wait until we have a Titan orbiter or perhaps a lander on the surface of Titan one day in the future.
What has surprised the scientists at JPL the most about any discoveries you made at Titan?
I would say, yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's kind of a good time in the mission to be asking that because as we're headed towards the end of mission, it's sort of thinking back to the beginning of the mission. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the mission, there was actually we had some reasonable data that thought that maybe there would be oceans on Titan, just big, huge swaths of oceans. And the fact that there wasn't oceans on Titan was surprising. How complex the chemistry is in Titan's atmosphere, I think, just has really surprised everyone. I mean, we knew that there was going to be complex chemistry going on in Titan's atmosphere. You know, when you have methane, which is a carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms, and the sunlight hits that, and then they break up, and then they recombine, and they never recombine as methane anymore. They recombine as other things, you know, C3H6C4H, any number, right? So you get acetylene and benzene and propane and propylene and all these sorts of things.
So very long hydrocarbon chain.
Exactly. Okay. And, you know, they put an instrument on board to measure that, and the instrument, you know, had what at the time was a very reasonable range, and it went up to, you know, 100 AMU. But there's so much complex chemistry going on that there are things in the atmosphere that are bigger and more complex than that.
The Cassini spacecraft has been in orbit around Saturn for quite a few years now. Sometimes it goes orbits in the equatorial plane, sometimes in the poles of Saturn. When it was looking at, there's a moon there called Enceladus. Can you please let our listeners know the interesting things about the moon Enceladus?
So Enceladus is quite possibly the biggest surprise of the mission so far. Enceladus is this small moon about the size of Iowa. And just to give you a reference, Titan is about the size of the United States. So this tiny moon about the size of Iowa. And we knew it was pretty interesting from the Voyager data. And so we had planned 3 flybys of it in the prime mission. And during those flybys, what we discovered really just knocked our socks off. There is a set of cracks at the south pole of Enceladus that is spewing geysers, water geysers, out into space.
So
some of the most incredible images, Marco, that you have seen from this mission are influenced by those geysers. Just incredible.
So where did the geysers, when the water sprouts out, does it go anywhere?
So the just like Titan and the moon in Jupiter's system, the Europa moon, there's an ocean underneath Enceladus, and that ocean we know now is hot because we have measurements of the particles that have gotten shot out into space have been picked up by our cosmic dust analyzer, and we know that there's little bits of sort of rocky silica that have to be created when water and rock are together at hot temperatures. So we know that there is a hot base to this ocean at Enceladus, and that base is in touch with the rocks underneath. And so then these little silicate rock things get formed, and then they drift up through the ocean, and they get to one of the near surface vents, and then it gets shot out into space. And mostly it's gas, right? It's water gas that gets shot out into space. But there are little bits and these little bits of rock that get shot out. But there's also methane gas and the water freezes and falls back onto the surface. So the southern part of Enceladus looks very soft. It's not very heavily cratered because it's been resurfaced with this light falling of snow that comes from these plumes. But one of our most dramatic images, which is called the Saturn high phase observation, where you look at Saturn when the sun is behind Saturn, and so you can see the whole Saturn system sort of backlit. One of the most dramatic features is what's called the E-ring, and it's not called the E-ring because it's created by the Enceladus plume, although it is created by the Enceladus plume. It just happens to be called the E-ring because that's the order in which we discovered them. We gave them names, you know, A, B, C, D, E. So this just happened to be the fifth one that we discovered. But it is, in fact, created by the Enceladus plumes. And it creates a beautiful backlit image. If you or your listeners have not seen the Cassini backlit image, that is well worth a few minutes to Google that.
What is the website, please?
Saturn.jpl.nasa.gov. And you could see all of our images there.
Wow.
And the occultation images are particularly beautiful.
For our listeners, what is an occultation?
So an occultation is when there's a body in front of another body. So when we have a solar occultation here on the Earth is when the moon moves in between the Earth and the sun. So it blocks out the sunlight, and there's a big shadow on the surface of the Earth. And if you're in that shadow, then you see an occultation of the sun by the moon. So you can have occultations of any sort, right? Out at Saturn, mostly what we have that we take images of, we have images of stars drifting through a Saturn's atmosphere or Titan's atmosphere or the rings of Saturn. We've learned an awful lot about those things, or even the plumes of Enceladus. We have the sun that drifts behind Saturn's atmosphere, Titan's atmosphere, the rings, and the plumes of Enceladus. And we also have occultations where, like, a moon gets in front of Saturn or in front of, if Titan drifts in front of Saturn, that's also a very pretty image. There's some science that can be done there, but it's also just visually appealing sort of to the human in us when we see pictures like that. So when I say that the occultation image you want to look at is when Saturn was occulting the sun.
I've seen a lot of the images, and some of them are with many crescent moons, because I believe the Saturn have 62 moons or more than that.
I think that's about the number we're at right now. But there's only about 8 or so that really matter, the big ones. You know, the big ones are really In fact, most of those moons were not discovered by Cassini. Most of those moons were discovered in a ground-based observing campaign. We've discovered some, for sure. And, of course, the big ones most we knew about sort of beforehand. And the big ones are the ones that really capture, you know, our attention because they're so different. And we learn so much about geology that we didn't even think we, you know, we didn't even know the questions to ask until you start getting really interesting images to look at the geology of this, some of these small moons and say, gosh, how does that happen? How does that work?
The end of the program is near, and you're working on something you can tell our listeners about. But first, how did you image the plumes from the Enceladus moon? And which kind of light? Is it visible or infrared? And does Enceladus orbit around the equatorial plane or above the equatorial plane? Or where does it orbit Saturn?
So all of the major moons orbit in the equatorial plane of Saturn, so right where the rings are. And Enceladus is in that group as well. It's only slightly inclined. That means the tilt of its orbit is only slightly different than, say, the tilt of the rings, which is aligned with the equator. And so all the major moons are aligned with Saturn's equator. And I think you also asked, we've imaged the plumes in visible light and infrared. We've also done UV and solar and stellar occultations of the plume. And one of the things about imaging the plume, though, remember how I said the plumes are shooting out these mostly water gas and then these little tiny bits of frozen water that, you know, because once the water hits the space, it freezes immediately into the little tiny particles.
Okay.
So it's really hard to see when you're looking at it with the sun behind you, but it's really easy to see when you're looking at it and the sun is on the other side. And sort of the way to remind yourself of this is when you get up in the morning and there's been a little bit of moisture overnight and you have some dew on your window, little tiny droplets of water on your window, and you get in your car and you're driving just fine until you turn out of your driveway east and the sun hits your window. And all those little particles, all of a sudden you're completely blind, right?
Yes.
Because of the way that the light bounces off of the tiny little particles.
Okay.
That is exactly what happens with us and the plumes of Enceladus. When the sun is on the other side is when you really get dramatic images of, and you can really see the details of the plumes.
We're back with Ms. Trina Ray from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and she's working on the fascinating Cassini mission, which has been in orbit in Saturn for quite a few years now. Now, the last question was, Trina, can you please tell us about the last mission of Cassini and what it's going to be and your involvement in it, please?
Sure. So this is going to be a really exciting end to the Cassini mission. This is going to happen out in 2017. And we are, even as we speak, we're starting to plan the sequences that in 2016 we'll take the spacecraft. Now, right now the spacecraft is orbiting in the plane of Saturn. And what we're going to do is crank the orbits up to a higher and higher and higher inclination until in 2017 we're at one of the highest inclinations we'll ever have been at in the mission, sort of 60 to 70 degrees. And then what we're going to do is right now we orbit on the outside of the ring. So every time Cassini goes by, we go by on the outside of the rings, and then we go off into the Saturn system, and then we come back and on the outside of the rings. But we're going to do a non-targeted Titan flyby, and that's going to change our trajectory, and we are going to plunge in between the planet and the rings. There's a little corridor, just a couple of thousand kilometers wide, that we think is free from enough debris that we will survive that passage. And we have 22 orbits inside the rings of Saturn before we crash into the planet. And that is just going to be so exciting. We're running out of fuel, so we have to dispose of the spacecraft. And one of the safe places to dispose of the spacecraft is into Saturn itself. And that means we have no danger of hitting Titan or Enceladus or one of these other moons that might have, you know, there might be interesting life or prebiotic chemistry there that we don't want to take our own, prebiotic and biotic chemistry and leave it on a moon. So disposing of the spacecraft in Saturn is very safe. And this is just, you know, Marco, this is going to be so exciting. So in 2017, you're going to be seeing some really exciting results.
That's amazing.
From the Cassini mission.
This gap it's going to dive in between, is that the Cassini division or what's it called?
No, the Cassini division is the division in the rings between the A ring and the B ring.
Okay.
So if you're at Saturn, looking out, the order of rings, like I said, remember we
yes.
ordered them in the when we discovered them. So, but just going radially, if you start at the sort of the surface of Saturn, you've got a gap. That's the gap I'm talking about.
Okay.
Then you have the D ring, the C ring, the A ring, the B ring. The B ring, the A ring, and then the F ring. So it's that gap that's in between below the D ring and Saturn.
So there's a lot of gaps, but the gap that you're going to go is
The Cassini is in between the A and B, and the Cassini division is littered with things. We would probably never make it through there.
So make it through means your spacecraft would be damaged beyond functionality, correct?
Right. So we're traveling by Saturn at 34 kilometers per second.
Okay.
So just think about that in your life.
Wow.
Think about something that's 34 kilometers away.
Okay.
And getting there in 1 second.
That's amazing.
That's how fast the Cassini spacecraft is traveling. So if we hit a marble, we're dead. You know, if we hit something, you know, 1/100th the size of a marble.
Great.
You know.
So it sounds like you guys have a lot more control of your spacecraft than the people at Pluto with their New Horizons spacecraft. Is that correct?
Well, we have a different, we're in different conditions, right? First of all, we've been at the Saturn system for quite some time.
Mm.
And so we've been orbiting and learning about the Saturn system. And so we've been able to refine all of the different things that the Pluto people didn't get a chance to refine, right? They were doing a flyby. So they didn't have a chance to really nail down even Pluto's orbit, except on the way in, they started taking ever better images on the way in. And we've been at Saturn for a long time, so we've been really able to figure out, you know, where everything is. And we've also had a chance to image all of these locations where we want to take the spacecraft. Now, we've imaged this gap, and we think it's perfectly fine. And so the science that we're going to get from plunging in between the rings and Saturn is so exciting that, you know, that's a good way to go, right, if you have to dispose of your spacecraft anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a truly unique piece of science sort of as you die is a great way for a spacecraft to go. And the two pieces of information that we're going to get that are something that our spacecraft has not been able to figure out, even though we've been in orbit for 12 or 13 years now. One of them is about the internal magnetic field of Saturn. The internal magnetic field of Saturn is very closely aligned with its rotational field, and it's just really tricky to get at the details of that, and so you have to get really close so you can measure very subtle things. So this will be as close as we'll ever get, and we have 22 shots through that gap. And the other thing is the mass of the B ring. That's one of those big, thick rings that are around Saturn. Not the A ring. The A ring and the B ring are, when you picture Saturn's rings in your mind, mostly what you're picturing is the A and the B ring, and the Cassini division is in between them. But the B ring is so thick that every solar occultation that we've used to try to see through it and see the details of its structure, every stellar occultation, everything we've tried to do to get our hands and put our finger on the mass of the B ring has eluded us. The B ring is just a little too thick, and the optics are not working. The optical properties of the rings are not cooperating with us. And so, if you put the spacecraft in between the planet and the rings, you separate out the gravitational signature of the two, and you're able to get at the mass of the B ring. So a fundamental property, a fundamental piece of information, one about Saturn and one about the rings, and then of course, Marco, we're right in that gap, right? We're right in the gap between the Saturn and the rings. So, of course, we're going to drift down every one of those 22 orbits. Some are a little closer, some are a little farther. And the last five, we actually swoop into Saturn's atmosphere, and we measure in situ Saturn's atmosphere using the instrument we put on the spacecraft to measure Titan's atmosphere.
That's amazing. Okay.
Oh, my gosh. It's so exciting. I'm getting goosebumps just telling you about it.
Well, I've been following Voyager for a long time, and then I've been following Cassini for a while now. And it's amazing stuff. It keeps me busy hours a day just looking at your science. So you've been doing a great job. And, you know, I really have to thank you for coming on our show. So this has been an interview with Ms. Trina Ray from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, one of the most amazing scientific places in the world, right? they do the most.
I think so.
Yes. So that's my dream, to visit it one day. So thank you, Trina, and all the information you gave us today was amazing. So thank you very much for your time and for all of your knowledge.
You are more than welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Trina.
Okay.
Bye.